very much, Susan, and it's a great pleasure to be here this morning. I think you'll recognize some common themes from what Anne-Marie and Ed and Jeff have talked about already this morning. And in fact, they're playing out in a broader context on sustainability and the evolution of it. So I'm going to start there with a bit of that broader context. Where I like to start, though, is very often I find that people don't really know how big a company Sobeys is now. It started business over 100 years ago in Atlantic Canada, and about 12 years ago was still that, and then acquired a Central Canadian and Western Canadian company and immediately tripled in size and has continued to grow since then. So we're actually now over $15 billion in sales across a number of different store banners, brands as we call them. I like to talk a bit about time in two ways, markers of time and markers of change. So let's start with the markers of time. About 25 years ago, I was doing an undergrad in environmental science, and we were talking about global warming and climate change. We weren't necessarily using those terms then, but it was certainly well known that this phenomenon was beginning to be recognized. At the same time, organic food is about 3% of sales in the supermarket. So in about a 25-year time span, you could say roughly, it's taken that evolution. So the point of that is to say that with the issues that we are facing, if we really are watching for them and attuned to them, we can't in 25 years from now still just be talking about it. And in 25 years, it can't be just 3% of the sales of products that are sort of maybe have evolved into what may be better practices. Now, one could argue organic does not equal sustainable, but I'll leave that for another day. The point is that we have to affect, you know, the mainstream, the way we do business. We cannot just think of it as a niche. So it has to affect the legacy systems and the way we deliver products and services. The good news is that change is happening, and actually it's gathering speed, and many of you may be well aware of that. But one way I measure it is 8 years ago when I was with Whole Foods, the CEO of PepsiCo globally, a company that at the time was 10 times the size of Whole Foods in a sales standpoint, was after an audience with the CEO of Whole Foods. Now, if many of you may have read about him, he's quite a legend, and he's a libertarian, so he's quite an alternative thinker. It wanted nothing to do with meeting with PepsiCo and considered the dark side. Eventually, after some pestering over some months, he agreed to do that, and he said to me, you know, you should come into the meeting as well. So I went in, and it was a very interesting meeting, and John Mackey, the founder and CEO of Whole Foods, wore his usual attire, which was some Teva hiking sandals, hiking shorts, and a Patagonia fleece. You can well imagine that the PepsiCo CEO and his two lieutenants arrived, all the spit and polish of the suit and tie and the shiny shoes and all the rest of it. So quite a clash already. Interesting meeting. I won't go through all the details. At some point, I'd love to tell you more about it. But the net result was they went through a PowerPoint. They showed us some products that were in development, some organic blue corn Tostitos chips that were not on the market yet, and sort of were playing us a little bit, which annoyed Mackey, but they invited me to try this new organic blue corn Tostitos chips. And in fact, brought out of their bag the product we were already selling, this Garden of Eden blue corn organic Tostitos chips from Hain & Celestial Group, which I knew very well I had bought for my family. And so I thought, well, that's quite a good product. I already know it, but okay, I'll try your new product. And I tried it. They had shown us a slide that showed that the consumer taste test showed 90% win preference for their product versus the one we were selling. And you know, my immediate reaction was, well, that's probably your customer, sort of the mainstream, but probably not the Whole Foods customer. But anyway, so I tried the product, and I smiled. I said, you know, congratulations. This is a great product. It's much better than the one that we sell. So they sat back smiling and thinking, job done. So I let them enjoy their moment for a minute, and then I said, but our customers also want to know the story. What's the packaging? You know, how much effluent was created? How recyclable or what sustainable materials are used in that? What about the factory that produced the product? Was it on a denuded wetland? What was the impact on that? How are you treating the workers that are working in the factory? And they looked at me like I was speaking Greek and said, well, nobody's ever talked to us about that before at all. This is just 8 years ago. You know, things that we're today calling kind of a life cycle analysis wasn't at all being considered. So they were fixating on the end product and the characteristics of bringing organics to the end product. Now, of course, we all know there are many dimensions beyond that. And so the reason for mentioning that is 8 years later, this global organization, the Consumer Goods Forum, that I'm on a steering committee with 20 people globally, Sobeys would be a small player considered. Most of it are the big players, the Kraft, the Unilevers, the Nestle's, the General Mills, the Coke, Sara Lee, and a number of others. And then there's Walmart and Carrefour and Tesco and a number of retailers. So in that organization, 400 of the largest consumer-facing companies in the world, retailers and manufacturers, the annual summit last year over 3 days, three-quarters of that agenda was about sustainability. This is not a sustainability conference. This was an annual conference for the general leadership, and three-quarters was on sustainability. And all these companies that I mentioned, and many, many more, have sustainability strategies and goals that they're working towards and understand fundamentally what life cycle analysis is about. So in 8 short years, things have been moving along quite a lot. And in fact, a lot of the work that I will refer to a little bit later is moving along at quite a pace. It's gathering speed. So the point is, this is going on. This is symptomatic of what's going on in life and accountability for what we sell and for our businesses. So sometimes I hear from the fishermen, well, why are you singling us out on seafood sustainability? And sometimes the livestock producers, why are you singling us out on animal welfare? Well, we're not singling anybody out. We're simply becoming more accountable. And therefore, we need to be more transparent. So from a retailer standpoint, then, yes, being more accountable for what we sell and fundamentally how we run our business in our direct operations, the stores, the trucks that service the stores, the warehouses that service them, only accounts for a very small percentage of the cumulative footprint that is incurred on behalf of our customers. Most of it comes from the products that we sell. And therefore, as we look to creating impact, it gets into the products that we're sourcing, the supply chain, and how those products are sourced and what are the characteristics. What it now is becoming, it's a need that all of us are needing to be accountable for. And so on that basis, it's not about competitiveness and racing to try to beat other people on that, because the cost of all of us doing unique proprietary things and the cost on the supply chain of throwing all these mixed messages would be humongous and probably create more barriers to progress than they would actual real progress. So it becomes a pre-competitive issue, and therefore opportunities to collaborate to really, you know, cost reduce and accelerate the progress along this journey. So I keep looking there, but I can't read the French. So so when it comes then to this accountability, some good phrases I've picked up from some of the auditing companies I sometimes talk to, whether it be on social compliance audits or environmental. Trust but verify, I think, is a great term. So it's not just about some of the leading producers and what practices they have and, you know, demonstrating that. But, when it has to become pervasive and a common denominator, there are going to be the people who aren't, frankly, carrying their weight, and we all know that. And you have to be able to sort through and sift that out. If we're going to be accountable, we need accountability from the people that we're sourcing from. So this idea of trust, it's not a matter of trust, as Ed pointed out earlier, right? But we need to be able to verify. Another auditor said, without documentation, it's just a rumor, which I think is a great line. And then I added my own line, which is, without measurability, it's just checking a box. In other words, if we're just talking best practices and you can't really quantify it and talk about the improvement, we're not really making progress either. So it's got to get down to that measurability aspect. So what is going on in this whole progress in our supply chains and our product sourcing? You know, moving from talking about food safety, which is still in development and still a lot of work going on, but adding the social and environmental characteristics, you know, well beyond best practices, you know, you need to see the performance and how can you understand where people are on a measuring stick, so to speak. As we all know, the days of a producer-defined standard are gone, right? It has to be a multi-stakeholder process. NFAC is great at sort of managing that, and, you know, very pleased that Jeff was up here prior to me and that, you know, we had the academics talking as well, too. Without those people involved in this process, I would have had trouble getting involved myself, frankly, because we're the days of a producer-defined direction are gone and not credible, and so we have to live with that world that we're in now. Auditing is a means to an end, not an end in itself. Really, it's about building capacity and ultimately better improvement in the conditions that are being experienced. So, understanding that, and I think a lot of the earlier phases of things up till the last little while have been too much focus probably on the auditing itself. And, producers can learn to pass audits pretty well and not necessarily deliver improved conditions. So very important that those two go together hand in hand, and understanding auditing as a means to an end, not an end in itself. This whole idea of proprietary solutions versus collaborative, and I'm going to talk some more about that on the next slide, but very important that there aren't, a multitude of different, ways of measuring things. And a classic example of that is an auditor goes into a production facility and he sees a fire extinguisher on a wall and it's on a hook, but there are two other hooks, one above it and below it. And he says, "Why do you have these other hooks here?" And the plant foreman says, "Well, that's easy. You know, when you come in, your customer specifies it's got to be at this height. But my other customer, when their auditor comes in, they want it at this height. And my other customer wants it at this height." Right? Great example of sort of, we're asking the same things in just a little bit different ways. And we got to get over that and get into the collaborative ways to make it easier, frankly, on you as producers to just deliver on what you want to do and not create confusion on things. So indicators of the need for collaboration, as I talk about, when you talk about social compliance, they're in fact globally, they found the Global Social Compliance Program that we're part of, which is a harmonizing process. When they started the work 3 or 4 years ago, found there were over 1,000 standards, codes, or criteria everywhere from the ILO, the International Labor Organization, down to different government standards, to proprietary industry, to company standards. And so it was quite a mess out there. And what was happening was you had audit fatigue being created. Well, not unusual for factories to be audited 20 or 30 times a year. Well, nobody's winning in that situation, right? As you producers would well understand that. On contrast, that with the environmental standards, where there really weren't anything significant out there, but a whole bunch of things in the works trying to fill that void. So all of a sudden, we're going to have all these different competing ways of measuring things as well. So, excuse me, the need to get to some, collaborative ways of defining how you measure things is really critically important. And again, just this idea of auditing as a means to an end, not an end in itself. Very often it's been about auditing and passing an audit and not necessarily delivering the improvement in condition. So that's the situation that's been out there with actually a pretty small percentage of companies doing this. So what would that look like now if all of a sudden it becomes that pre-competitive piece that I talked about, that we're all going to be accountable now for our supply chains and everybody's doing it and everybody's doing it in different ways? This doesn't reflect that. So imagine how chaotic that would be. So clearly we need to get to collaborative solutions. So two things I talk about, one on sort of the supply and one demand side in terms of radicalness, that term gets thrown around, collaboration and transparency. So let's just talk about those really quickly. These are some examples of harmonizing, bringing things together. On the food safety side, many of you would probably be well aware of the Global Food Safety Initiative, which took 5 regional food safety standards, and often there were producers who were getting certified in one, but encountered customers who didn't recognize that they had a different one they wanted. So the effort was, let's bring that together so that if you get audited on one, it gets recognized and accepted, for all 5 of those. It's actually some of the people who worked on that then said, as they were sitting around one day, what else are we working on and thinking about? And this was Walmart and Carrefour and Tesco and IKEA were doing this, and said, whole idea of sort of sweatshop factories and things is obviously very important, and we're all working on that. Maybe we should think about that same idea on the social compliance aspect of things. And so that's a great process that's been underway and beginning to really deliver some really good results on that as well. The Global Packaging Project, similar kind of idea. Packaging stands out because of how visible it is. It typically may only be 2 to 10% of the footprint of a product plus package, but it's very conspicuous. And, we're all familiar with the blue box programs and such that industry is paying a big portion of. So how can we harmonize the way that we measure it to make it simpler and easier to affect that step change? So the Global Packaging Project has been all about that. And then on a similar way, this Consumer Goods Forum that I mentioned is now going beyond the packaging to the product itself and trying to standardize the way that we measure the footprint of a product, starting with the carbon footprint, but moving beyond that to water and waste and biodiversity. So we're working on a way, essentially look at it as a measurement system. You know, we say what gets measured gets done, but if we're all measuring differently, it's pretty hard to deliver that kind of cohesive, you know, step change. So we have measurement systems for everything else in life, for time and currency and for weights and measures. Sustainability has seemed kind of, hard to decipher for a lot of people because we've not been able to nail it down. And so this idea of a measurement system is critically important and will help enable that. Of course, the measurement and defining a way to measure things is only the first step. The data capture is clearly a big part of it, and data sharing, and you want to enable a cost-effective way of data capture. So that's clearly part of it and relevant to the conversation here as well. And then the final thing, the GS1, you wouldn't be aware of likely, but they are the people behind the UPC barcodes that you see on all the products. And so there is a data pool out there of all the products that we sell in the supermarket industry in Canada that has, every product has a data fields that are connected to it that talk about some base specifications of that. And so, you know, it's realistic to say those could be augmented to add more characteristics about sustainability to those and beginning to that data sharing kind of process. And ultimately, where that may come will actually be to the radical transparency side of things, making that available to the consumer. Now, it's already beginning to happen. If you go to goodguide.com, you'll find over 70,000 products, many of which you'll be familiar with, being rated according to the health and wellness and sustainability characteristics of it. A similar thing, Barcoo.com out of the UK is doing the same kind of thing, and they both have smartphone apps, and there's a rating system, that's the Good Guide toolbar that's up there. Now, the fact that they don't have all the data they need to make these measurements is not stopping them from doing that. They're taking what's publicly available, and they're interpolating the rest of it. So the point that I make to business is, whether you like it or not, this is happening. That train's left the station. And you've got to understand what this will mean to your business to have that amount of transparency about what you sell. And therefore, you know, it takes some time to evolve. If, you know, we're all going to have warts, we need to evolve to improve some practices. But understand this is where it's going. And then the other decision would be, would we like it to be our data as opposed to what people are interpolating? And so that's this other side of it. And Walmart helped to create a couple of years ago a group that's doing some great work, the Sustainability Consortium, which actually quite engaged with the consumer goods forum that I mentioned too. And they're working on really driving this proactively to a standardizing measurement, to a cost-reduced way of capturing data. And ultimately, it may end up being a label on a product that shows a relative sustainability measure for a product, so that within a category of products, you can choose the ones that have a lower environmental footprint, if that's what you so choose to do. So this is where it's going. And so when we talk about animal welfare and are we being singled out, no. This is the direction that the world is moving into. So we've had to be reactive on seafood and packaging. You know, we hadn't had this kind of sort of transparency into our sourcing, frankly, across the board. And this is new now a new era we're ushering into. We're working hard to address the issues that need to be addressed. And I would say that there are some things in animal welfare and sustainable agriculture from our perspective are things that offer an opportunity to be proactive, to not have to be on the defensive, but to be taking advantage of the opportunity where it's not, you know, out being challenged in the media all the time, to actually move forward on this in a very proactive, deliberate way. And that's why, you know, I think I'm very encouraged by the whole work of NFAC and the ACAM model, because it offers such a great opportunity to be proactive on this. And to be able, frankly, to keep improving on all the good stories that, you know, are already out there to be told. So just very quickly, NFAC has certain objectives or goals that it defines, and I've simply said why these seem to be relevant for food service and retailers, which, hence, prior to now, probably weren't nearly as engaged, as I say, in knowing the characteristics of the products that we sell anywhere to the degree that we are needing to become that way now. So a credible science-based approach, as I mentioned, if it were not for the academics and you know, Jeff being involved in the work that's being done would be less interesting for us as buyers of these products. So this whole idea of today needing to be a multi-stakeholder process, as we all know, is simply the way it's got to be done. It can't be just producer-defined. Science-based, you know, emotion is important in life, and we, you know, we get a lot of emotion being, you know, shown to us, and that's you know, a good way to challenge things. But fundamentally, it, you know, you want to base it on some real science, and that's where we're very much committed to. A standardized approach, you know, as I say, we haven't had that transparency. We don't have animal welfare experts on our staff as retailers and food service companies for the most part. McDonald's may have as a sort of a pretty narrow product focus and being able to focus on that, but generally that's not the case. So what we need to do, in the same way we're not experts on seafood sustainability on our staff either, you know, we need to engage with those stakeholders, become more informed about it, but ultimately let the experts agree on some principles, but let the process work through and deliver some great results. So, you know, not wanting to get hands-on in all the weeds of every single, you know, code and program that every livestock group would have, NFAC and the ACAM model is a great leverage opportunity for us to be able to then, you know, show how important it is to show some influence and encouragement for it without getting into the weeds on everything. So, and, you know, if we can, you know, work with the MFAC approach and kind of endorse that as a credible way to proceed, you know, that then confers, if people can follow along in that approach, we can all be on the same page on what credibility it takes. So, facilitating information sharing, you know, really, I think it's a great way to accelerate the adoption of all the progress, and certainly, you know, a great way for us to connect and know who to talk to and sort of work through a network, which we previously really hadn't had. And then just the links, again, this alignment with government, you know, having Susie Miller up here talking yesterday, you know, really important to send that message out there, and having that linkage and alignment really important. And broadly, you know, to be able to connect with the supply chain and be able to send that message of encouragement and support and to really move the ball forward, I think is really important. But really important, too, creating more awareness amongst the retailers and food service that this stuff is going on, and many of them probably are not well enough aware of it, will help stop them from going out and creating their own program, when, especially if they're you know, having to feel like they're reactively defending themselves against some environmental group, you know, that comes to them asking for something. As I like to say, you know, these are systemic issues that need to be addressed, and they need to be addressed systemically. I think it's broken to be out there, you know, each individual company to have its own set of requirements. As I mentioned, that fire extinguisher is a great example of that. So thanks very much.
Well, we'll start it anyway. I just wondered how Sobeys, that's Neil Jotham, I just wondered how Sobeys approaches the situation facing, or the, how are they, when they're faced with product boycotts that are put forward by individual groups trying to achieve an objective that they think is important, and they use the product boycott to try and achieve that?
It happens very rarely. And, you know, we serve the mass audience. We're not a niche player. When I was with Whole Foods, that's obviously a niche player, and they can take more, you know, advanced sort of, you know, niche kinds of positions. So if you buy into the fact that, you know, you want to affect things on a broader scale, not just a niche, if that's really what we're all about, and I started off by saying that's what needs to happen, then address them in a cohesive, a substantial way, and not sort of a niche little play and reacting to little pieces. And of course, there's always unintended consequences, you know, so solve one issue but without thinking about the rest of them, and you can create some other ones too. So happens you know, very rarely, again, we want to be science-based too, and a lot of that's often about emotion, well-intentioned, but emotion. So I'll use seafood as an example. Greenpeace thinks, based on their list, they think some species belong on their red list, things that have some critical issues. Okay, and there are different red lists. So if you talk to, the Dave Suzuki Foundation, there's a different, and so there's a whole bunch of different lists out there. So Greenpeace premise is, we think it's got critical issues, and we think you should stop selling it, right? But well-intentioned, but overly simplistic. You can't talk about one species and red list that, because there are many different fishing areas where that species is caught, and the status of the biomass of the fish themselves, the population, can be in a very different situation in each one of those fishing areas, and the management practices can be very different, and even the gear types can be very different that are used. So to paint it all with one brush and say, don't do it, doesn't make any sense, and it confuses it more than it really helps. And also, there's some philosophical things involved in that. So they don't believe that you should be doing any trawling, dredging on the bottom of the seafloor. And that is very harmful in most situations. But it turns out on sandy seafloors, which tends to be the case in a lot of Atlantic Canada, and the Department of Fisheries and Ocean Studies have shown this, it's not particularly harmful because there's not a lot of biological activity down there anyway. And therefore, you're not really disturbing it that much. So it's not such a big issue. So Atlantic haddock and Atlantic halibut are on the red list now for Greenpeace, and they think that we should stop selling that. And our view on this whole thing is you lose the ability to affect change by disengaging. And the management practices that are going on, and those, frankly, are by no means what I would consider some of the most egregious issues, those two species. There are many others globally, and 60% of seafood consumed in Canada is imported, so it's a globalized supply. There are many other out there that should be focused on much more than that, but we can affect change by engaging and helping with capacity building to change the management practice. If we disengage, those management practices will stay the same, and they'll just sell to a different market that's less discerning and doesn't care about it. So that's fundamentally our approach, and I'm happy to, and I share that with Greenpeace all the time, disagree. And in fact, on that note, because we sort of talked about the emotion aspect, we are doing some fundamentally deep and substantive things on seafood that other retailers aren't doing. We're not getting credit for it because Greenpeace's rating system weights some very short term, almost frankly, and I've said to them, you're encouraging greenwashing, and so you're rating people on that. And I don't want to get off on a Greenpeace bashing thing. I guess I have. But it's an example. I'm using it as an example. Why a collaborative, informed, stakeholder-engaged process that recognizes the issues, commitment to move forward on them, and deal with them systemically, I think, is the most appropriate way forward.
John Davidson, Maple Leaf Foods. Great presentation, David. My question is, you talk about how it's important to get the retailers and food service companies all on the same page in this so everyone doesn't go out and do their own thing and set a bunch of different standards that are counterproductive. I'm wondering what's being done in the food service and retail industry to communicate this and get people on the same page.
Yeah, I think that's a great question, Don. Thanks for asking that, because I didn't really talk about that. So, a few years ago I started to, I guess about 3 years ago, I started to do a little bit of work in this space, and actually one thing led to another, and I ended up talking to Susan. And we had some good conversations, and then she connected me to Jackie, and some good conversations. And, I talked to a number of our suppliers and kind of got a sense of where things were at, and then some time went by, and I got a call from Jackie, hey, we're forming this animal care assessment model steering committee, and we'd really like to have a retailer involved, would you participate? So, once she explained what it was all about, I said, yeah, that seems like a high leverage opportunity. Do it once, do it well, and then leverage that across the different commodity groups. So I said, I'll definitely get involved. And as we got into it, and I kept hearing everyone talking, we really need more engagement with the buyers, with the food service and retailers. I said, well, I can deliver that. So I created an advisory committee of retailers and food service companies that I lead, and use that to take the work of the animal care assessment model and get their feedback on it. What do you think? How is it? And also increase awareness on their part that this stuff is going on so that they can understand that and participate and encourage the process and begin to, sort of frankly expect it of the supply chain, which they may not have if they hadn't been engaged in it. So we're working on that. It's still a work in progress, but CFRA, or CRFA, what is, I always mix that up. But anyway, the Restaurant and Food Service Association is very much interested in engaging and understanding what's going on, too. So it's a work in progress. But
I guess I'm next. Hi, David. I'm Jeff Spooner, UBC. Thank you very much for your insights this morning. David, as a social science researcher, we spend a lot of time talking to members of the general public about their views on animal welfare. And we've got a comfort level, I think, now in terms of what the citizen thinks about welfare, what they tell us, certainly. We also encounter something called an attitude-behavior gap, which is a breakdown somewhere, perhaps, or a failure to translate one into the other in terms of practice. From the retail side, can you shed some light on that for us? What's your perspective on consumer views with regard to welfare products? Thanks.
Yeah, so I think you've got a lot of great stuff within that question, right? Sort of the gap between awareness and behavior, right? Answering surveys and saying, yeah, I believe in this, this, and this, but the behavior when they actually shop and consume not reflecting that. So that's part of it. And the way I talk about that is an aspiration gap. So people may aspire to live a certain way, and health and wellness is also a similar thing. But there are barriers to the reality versus the aspiration, and often those are knowledge, you know, cost, and convenience. And so so the other part of it is the fact that, you know, people are, you know, pretty much price sensitive, and increasingly so today. And therefore, you know, many of these characteristics have to be thought of as value added, not as, you know, gee, you can charge a premium for this stuff now, right? You want to understand that context. So moving it forward, you know, a lot of it's got to be fairly seamless for the average consumer. You know, there's only a small percentage of them, and pick your element. Is it animal welfare? Is it climate change? Is it water scarcity? Is it, you know, toxicity or biodiversity? Sustainable seafood, only a small percentage of it are really informed and going to take action on it. However, there's quite a big chunk who, if they were more informed, might be quite engaged on it, and that's an opportunity for a retailer to make it easier for them, for sure, to close that aspiration gap. Is that...
Okay. Hi, I'm Mike Petrick with the CVMA. You talked about the pressure that the retailers face to improve on a number of different issues, environmental, animal welfare, human health. Do you have in your scheme, do you have a hierarchy of these issues? Because it's seldom that we can come up with a win-win-win, you know, program. You know, and if an improvement in animal welfare causes it to be less environmentally friendly, or an improve in human health causes less, you know, whatever. Is there a direction that you know, that the different issues will steer an issue?
This is a really important point. You know, sustainability is often talked about as a triple bottom line. You know, the bottom line we all are familiar with is the financial, but it's adding the social and the environmental to it. And, you know, they often show interlocking circles, much like Jeff showed on his schematic and relative to the different animal conditions. But so three interlocking circles, triple bottom line, not about walking away from the things, the profitability element that we've had. It's about adding to our decision-making the social and environmental consequences, which really, frankly, we haven't had really in business, have we? And that's why this measurement system to help enable that is really critically important. But one why I would say is I'm fundamentally an optimist about all of this stuff. Because what gets measured gets done, and we haven't been measuring it. So there's a lot of low-hanging fruit out there that now that we get measuring and get it on our radar and start making informed decisions for business about what are the social and environmental impacts, we can make some changes. A lot of low-hanging fruit. So, but there are very difficult trade-offs. There's no easy sweet spot in the middle there usually. And so you can end up with a balance in how do you trade them off. You want to be careful of burden shifting, you know, solving one thing or unintended consequences. So there are no easy solutions at all, and that gets into a bit of the judgment side of things, I guess, you know, getting beyond the science. And I know Jeff's coming up after me, and he spoke after me down in another thing, and I talked about being science-based too, and as he correctly pointed out, science will take you so far, and judgment at some point has to get involved. So. All right? Thanks, Susan. Thanks a lot. Okay.
Thank you.